Thank you, and thank you very much for inviting me to speak here today. So I'm going to try and answer the questions, can museums make good games and should they? And I'll give you a spoiler alert, my answer to both of those is yes. So I'm a freelance digital producer and consultant. I have a particular interest in games. I've worked on various different projects, but particularly games. I've commissioned games, some very successful ones. I've produced games, evaluated games, consulted on games. I run game design workshops. So I think a lot about games. I also play a lot of games, which is very, very important if you're at all thinking about whether games are something you should be doing in your institution. I highly recommend you go out and play games. And I also, another of my kind of side messages, I'd like to try and convince you that games are about, perhaps you already know this, but that games are about more than perhaps some of the most obvious examples you might have played, whether this is on your mobile phone or the ones that you've seen on the console. There is a whole range of amazing games out there. This is just one example that most people will never have seen because it only goes and tours at festivals, called Roffle Pillar by a company called Lucky Frame. And in this, they use a controller in which you're using a sleeping bag, rolling around in the sleeping bag, in order to control the movements of a caterpillar on screen. This is just something that somebody's invented and uses at festivals. So games are hugely broad. Games can be just an incredibly varied range of things, and do a range of things for people. And I really want people to be thinking about games, as I said, in terms of that range. And that, for me, includes board games and physical games, which have enjoyed a huge renaissance recently in the UK, but I mean, particularly also in the rest of Europe as well, very popular. And have, in turn, can inspire you to thinking about digital games. Mobile games, of course, have been, in the time that I've been working on games, have just exploded in their use. The average gamer now is somebody sort of in their mid-30s. The gender split is roughly equal. It's a very changed place from where it was 20 years ago. Can I ask the audience, has anybody here never played a game in their life? No. Games are universal. Everybody plays games at some level and in some way. Even animals will play games. If you Google iPad games for cats, surprising number out there, and they will actually work. So games are a really universal feature of human life and also animal life. Games are a major part of our culture. I think most people will recognize Sonic. This was a game from my childhood, giving away my age, growing up in the 80s. We played. Does anyone recognize this, Chuck E. Egg? This was a game that I played for days. Days and days lost to this very simple game that I loved, and my cousins and I would all get together and play it for hours and hours for the BBC Micro. This game probably needs no introduction here, Pokemon Go. I don't know if it's as huge in Hungary as it has been elsewhere. It enjoyed a spike of massive popularity, which is testament not just to the power of games, but also the power of the Pokemon brand, which came out of games and has been around for the last 20 years or so. Games are a huge part of our culture and often neglected, I feel, by the cultural sector, as seen as sometimes as insignificant and unimportant. Although, as I'll show you, there are other examples of museums getting very involved with games. This is the example that first got me really excited about the potential for games. It's called I Love Bees. It was an alternate reality game played online and in the physical world, actually a promotion for Halo 2, a console game. But they used a website to give people coordinates to a telephone, a public telephone in the United States. And people spontaneously organized themselves together to make sure that they were at that telephone, at that coordinate, at the time given, and they were given instructions to relay a message across the United States to another telephone, and if the person was there when the puppet masters of the game called, they would unlock a new part of the story. And thousands of players came together without any structure given to them to spontaneously organise and solve these problems, to the degree that by the end of it they were able to relay messages within seconds. They essentially created new technology in order to be able to do that, just to play the game. Not because they wanted the prize, they didn't know what the prize was. They were just enjoying the mechanics of the game so much. At one point, one of the actors had to tell somebody to get off the telephone because they'd gone out into a hurricane in order to get the next part of the clue. That's how powerfully engaging games can be. And also, note that collaborative. I think a lot of people think that games are very competitive, and I think in a museum setting, in an educational setting, that can feel quite, that feels wrong maybe, that you don't want to be pitting people against each other. But I want to assure you that games can be very cooperative. I don't know if anybody's played Space Team. In my ideal world, we would all just stop now and play Space Team together. And I could show you this example, but maybe go home tonight. It's free, download it. It's a game in which the mechanic is basically, the rules of the game are that essentially you're working together as a space team. Each person has information that other people don't have and they need. So you must talk to each other in order to convey this information. So the game automatically encourages discussion. You cannot play the game without becoming a space team. It's fantastic fun. So they can be very social. So my first specific museum game example is High Tea. And excuse me the indulgent, but this is a game that I commissioned for the Wellcome Collection in the UK in London a few years ago now, as part of an exhibition of which is about the history of drugs and narcotics throughout the ages, a very small part of which was about the Opium Wars. And we thought this was a fascinating area of history, very little talked about within the UK. The British Empire behaved very badly, so controversial as well. And the central theme, or the central trading activity that happened, is what we wanted our players to understand. And that activity was buying opium, selling opium, buying tea. And note here the learning objective, understanding the trade, is embedded in the game. You have to play the trading mechanic in order to succeed in the game, in order to play the game. So by doing that, you automatically learn how that trade worked. Very powerful feature of games for learning. Huge success. We have, this is, you can see the huge spike in the opening weekend of over 200,000 players, I think. Last time I looked, over 4 million plays. So not only can the games be very engaging, but also reach a potentially very, very big audience. This was kind of before the days where mobile games were so popular. Now I would do it differently. We'd just release this online, but you can go and play it if you like, Google High Tea. The thing for me that's most pleasing is not the numbers, it's the response that we got. People wrote blog posts about the economics of High Tea. They posted it on Metafilter. They created YouTube videos. They commented not just about the gameplay, but unusually in these spaces, they commented about the content of the game. At the top, my favorite quote, "How come I only understood what I'd seen in a museum after playing this game?" Other examples, there are many, many examples from other museums doing similar sorts of online games. This is, and for mobile more recently, this is Rugged Rovers from the Science Museum. I think probably one of their most recent games, very popular in it. You create a rover machine, and then you test it out in the real world, in their constructed world, to see how far you can make it go. Very popular, but also teaching about kind of engineering principles. Very, very playful, and you can play it both in the gallery and online. So, in some ways, I hope that kind of convinces you that there is a lot of potential with games to be very familiar and popular, engaging and educational. Another note about High Tea is over 50% of players, we did a big evaluation, you can read this online, over 50% of players said that they would go on to do their own research into the subject after playing the game. So we didn't aim to teach them everything about the subject. We aimed to get them interested, and then they would go off and actively search, Google it, search Wikipedia, and so on. My caveat is we had a good budget. We had, for high tea, £40,000. Actually, still not enough money. Our games company probably lost money doing this. I don't know how much Rugged Rovers cost. I'm going to guess at least £100,000. I appreciate that that is a budget that is out of the realms of a lot of smaller museums. Perhaps with funding, I've seen smaller museums do quite interesting projects of that kind of scale. Games can also be very small and use free tools. So this is another example of a game using a platform called Twine, which essentially creates, you can use put into text and pictures, and the letter involved, which is love here, is clickable. And from that very simple thing, you can create lots of different alternatives. So in other ones, there might be three or four options, and you can click through and take different routes through a story, and you can make that very playful. Kind of like the text adventures that I suspect some people will remember from 20, 30 odd years ago. And in this case, they commissioned artists to do Twine games around particular subjects using, I think in some cases, images from their archives. Another model is bringing games that exist already into institutions. This is a festival called Now Play This in the UK, run at Somerset House. And in this, all kinds of indie developers brought beautiful games. My favorite being on the bottom right, a game played with light as the board. Just gorgeous, gorgeous examples. And very, very popular. Lots of, a really interesting range of people, lots of families came into this building that they wouldn't have otherwise come into. Hopefully this will be running again next year. So if you have the chance, I definitely recommend you go. Games can also be tiny, tiny things. There's a niche world of game poetry in which you create a poem which is also a sort of conceptual game in its own right. Welcome again commissioned several of these for one of their events. An example, The Sleeper Wakes. If you're in bed with someone who's sleeping, get a point for each time you manage to make them rotate 90 degrees. You lose if they wake up. You could play that. I think it's just more fun to just think about how that might work. So this is something I could talk to you about for the next half an hour, but what I want to show you actually is an example of the way in which games are not about genius. There are genius game designers out there who just come up with these ideas spontaneously out of their head, but I guarantee you they're still at some point following this process that I'm about to show you. For most of us, games are actually more accessible than we think by just going through a very, very simple process of essentially trial and error. Before I get to that, and I don't want to dwell on this because this is quite negative, there are many ways to make bad museum games. I have my list, I'm not going to go through that. I've seen a lot of games fail. Mostly, at the heart of this, it's by not following the process that I'm about to show you. It's by not engaging with the ideas of what games are, by not playing games and understanding how they work. If you do that and you have a spirit of trying things out, the risks are really minimal. You can use the process I'm about to show you and reduce the risk by just trying it ahead of time. So, how do you make good museum games? I'm going to show you. Now, I've never tried doing this in a room where lots of the people are wearing translators, so please bear with me, but we're going to play a game together called Cat on Your Head. So, I'm afraid people up there and on this side are going to miss out for the moment because I don't want you running through the wires. We have a health and safety issue. So you're my players here. Okay, is everyone ready? So I'm going to start with Tom. Can I call on you as someone I know? Would you mind starting off as my cat? Who can see a cat on Tom's head? Oh, no. Well, okay, Tom, thank you. How about, Tom, if you start after me, you say cat, 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 cat. cat, cat. As loud as you can. Fantastic. Who can see a cat on Tom's head now? Thank you. Okay, so we're going to move the cat around. So you move the cat by tapping on someone's shoulder, and then they have the cat. So they say cat, 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 cat. Keep it going, keep it going. Keep going, where's the cat? Keep going. Wherever you can reach. Excellent, we've got it there it is. Maybe forward one. Fantastic, we've got the idea. Okay, so I'm going to restart the cat over there in a second. But what would we need? We've got a cat, we need something for the cat to do, maybe something for the cat to chase. What should that be? A mouse. We can hold the thought with a dog. Great, so would you like to be the mouse? The mouse works in the same way. You say mouse, mouse, mouse. Fantastic. So you guys are quite close together. So the cat is going to try and chase the mouse the same way by moving through the audience. And the mouse is going to try and run away. And I'm going to give you about 30 seconds to try this out. And then we'll stop and we'll see how that worked. On your marks, get set, go. Keep it loud, keep it loud. The cat caught the mouse. Yay, okay, fantastic. So we made that a little bit too easy there, I think, for the cat. You were too close together. So can I keep the mouse over there, but start the cat in the front row here? Is that okay? Will you be my cat? The lady here in front, okay, fantastic. So you might have to reach over if you have a bit of a gap, but I'm gonna start you again, 30 seconds, starting now. So you say cat, 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 and then move the cat. Where's the mouse? Oh, you've got about 10 seconds. Run away, mouse. I think the mouse is in the back row over there. I think the cat just caught it in time. Okay. So it's about evened up now. The cat and the mouse, it's about the same level. The cat just got the mouse. What else could we add in there to make it a bit more interesting? Any other rules that we could add? The mouse?
Mouse hole.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So we have a mouse hole. So maybe the mouse hole. Who's got a piece of paper? A program or something with them? Hold up if you've got a piece of paper in your hand. There we go. So we've got one mouse hole there. I need one more. One over there. Great. So when the mouse hole hits him, it can jump. Or it can jump over there. So you have to shout, mouse hole, and then you'll jump over there. Get it? Okay. Fantastic. So we're going to start again with the cat in the same place and the mouse in the same place. On your marks, get set, go. Where's the cat? So we have cat starting here. Yes, yeah. Where did it go? Okay, let's restart the cat. So make sure you're starting with the cat, mouse over there, and go. Cat, yep. Where's the mouse? Oh, the cat's coming for the mouse. Ah. Okay. I'm going to just do one more because we're running out of time. Any other ideas of rules that you could add into this?
Several cats, one mouse.
Several cats, one mouse. I like it. That would be interesting. We had a dog over here. Maybe the dog could chase the cat. Any other ideas? Mouse trap. We've also had, I've run this and had examples of a mouse that has to catch different cheeses. So sometimes I play this with the yellow balloons and it has to catch the four cheeses before it goes down. That's quite interesting. We've had one where somebody introduced an owl. I don't know why, but there was an owl flying around the outside. So What we've just done there is an iterative game design process. And it kind of showed that we had some game designers in the room, people thinking about rules. That's all it is. You're identifying the things you want to achieve with a game. You're coming up with a rough idea for how you think it might work. The chances are it won't. Most games start off horrible, and it's a painful process to go through. But you draft that game, and then you immediately start testing it. Even with a digital game, you can test with post-it notes and pieces of paper. It will be bad, you will quickly find reasons why it's bad, and you will go back to the drawing board and try it again. You keep doing that over and over and over again. This works. I promise you this works. And if it doesn't work, you've lost very little. All you've done is used up some post-its and some paper, and you've lost nothing. But I promise you, this is the process of getting into any kind of, and it works for more than just games, it works for other digital processes as well. But the iterative game design process means that anybody can be a game designer. A few links, if you're interested in this, if you're at all thinking about using games within your institution, I highly recommend you just try playing as many as possible. See what's out there. It is totally fine to use other people's games mechanics. That's how games work. People evolve existing game mechanics. So check what's out there. I'll tweet a link to a blog post that has some more of this stuff, but notice I've added in a board game cafe local here in Budapest, which I would recommend trying. If you want, feel free to get in contact with me on LinkedIn or through Twitter. Thank you very much.